good evening, everyone. Good to be practicing with you. I was thinking, in preparing for this talk, I was thinking of this experience that I had a couple of years ago. How's the volume? Is volume good? Is it too much? No? Right on target? Okay, great. Sounds kind of loud to me, but I don't know. A little louder? A little louder. I hear a little louder. Yeah, okay, how's that? Is that good? Okay. Okay. Keep me posted, and if it drops, just raise your hand. Got that. So I was assisting. Occasionally what I'll do is I'll go out to Spirit Rock for a day, and I'll assist one of the teachers there, and generally do the guided practice discussions with people who want them, or things like that, and was assisting. I was one of, maybe there were three of us or something, assisting Jack Kornfield one day. And so did these guided practice discussion meetings with people one-on-one for much of the day. And then in the afternoon we did Q&A. And so they would divide the group up into two, and half the group would stay with Jack and maybe one other person, and then the other half would go up the hill to the dining hall. So there'd be like 100 or 150 people there, and we'd do Q&A with them, questions and answers. And there was one other person with me who was assisting as well, and people can ask, the students can ask whatever they want. And as assistants, we would just take turns, kind of go back and forth, one to the other. He would take one question, and then I would take the next, and so on and so forth. And it was my colleague's turn, and the person that he chose said, "Hey, you know, I'm new to the practice, but I could, you know, I just have the kind of personality where I could do this every day. You know, I could really do that. And I have a decent amount of time in my life. How long should I sit for every day?" My colleague just sat for a moment, paused, and he just said, "It's helpful if you can sit for long enough for discomfort to arise." I was like, "Oh, that's a really good answer. I like that. Very good one." Which is quite counterintuitive, you know? We don't usually... did anybody here sign up for a discomfort? Well, actually, we all did, but not at least knowingly, right? And so what I want to do tonight is talk a bit about discomfort on a few different levels, the physical level, the emotional level, and also on the collective level. And in terms of practice, really about learning to be with discomfort. Learning to deepen our ability to be with discomfort. And it happens over a period of time. Yeah, it doesn't happen all at once. The first time I meditated, I took it was a 5 or 6 week class with Howie Cohn, one of the Spirit Rock teachers in the city. And at the end of that first evening, we meditated. It was probably, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes, something like that. And it was all I could do to keep my eyes closed for that long. And I was just squirming all over the place, and pain was arising, and it was just really challenging. Over time, I've learned, I've kind of broadened and deepened my ability to be with experience, yeah? As I think many of you have that experience. And it's a really valuable thing to do. It's really useful in our practice. I mean, I know that a lot of you have learned it because just during that first meditation, during that sitting period, there's just, there's a level of stillness and quiet in this room, in this sangha in particular, that is not necessarily the case in a lot of other sanghas. One thing I want to say about this is that the learning to be with discomfort is different. It doesn't have anything to do with the demand for comfort to go away, with our insistence that it be other than it is. And it also doesn't have to do with learning how to hold ourselves rigidly so that we don't move, so that we're in this fixed position. the gritting your teeth model is not what I want to teach here. The Buddha actually mentioned that at one time in one discourse, but I'm not going to go into that tonight. That's the only place I know of in the discourses where that's mentioned. But so one suggestion for you right now would be to treat this period of the talk as practice. And I know many of you do this already. But for some of you who haven't, maybe to you could even do that more deliberately. And to stay still, and when discomfort arises, simply bring the attention to what the experience is before you move. So there's a little bit of, we bring some mindfulness to it, we rest the attention there, we investigate a little bit, and then we adjust, right? That can be with the scratch, can be with the shifting, whatever, just noticing this. I also want to say here at the beginning that we're hardwired to push away discomfort. We're hardwired to move toward comfort and away from discomfort. So those are simply natural movements of the heart and mind. There is nothing wrong with that desire or the fact that you move away from it. So to the extent that you can help create a judgment-free zone and keep the judgments at bay, I wholeheartedly encourage that. Much bigger on curiosity. Raise the curiosity, decrease the judgment. Okay. So if we just look at the experience, or really kind of more the collection of experiences that we call pain. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of experiences that we simply lump into this bucket. We call it pain, and pain is bad. Anybody not know that pain is bad? Okay, pain is bad. We want to get rid of it. We want it to go away. Pain comes. You take Tylenol, ibuprofen, something stronger than that. You know, whatever. And this is very common. We want to find ways to soothe that pain. So if we investigate that, it could include a variety of different experiences, right? Even in terms of temperature, it could be hot, or it could be cold. There could be a twitching to it, or a fieriness to it, or a stabbing quality, or a burning. Shooting, a throbbing, a pulsing, a numbing, a fatigue or weakening, that kind of thing. A whole collection of other experiences. This is kind of like the starter list here. Commonly, I think much of the time what happens is that we have this experience arises in the body. It's unpleasant. We don't like it. We start to push it away. We call it pain. We lump it. It's bad. Get rid of it. You know. And so I think with and that's really that pushing away. Once we're starting to actively push it away, then that's aversion, right? We all get aversion. We all get that mind that wants to push experience away. We all get that mind of greed, that mind that wants to hold on to get. We want the good. We want to get rid of the quote unquote bad, right? And as I mentioned earlier, we're hardwired for this. There's nothing wrong with this. However, there's no freedom in this. There's no freedom in simply go if we just have these rote reactions. What the Buddha taught about freedom is that it doesn't come from getting pleasant. I have a friend who she saw some movie. I think it was like one of the Star Trek movies or something, and they end up on this planet that's like this bliss planet, you know. That's maybe it's like made up of their fantasies or something. The Buddha was not. Oh, and my friend was saying, "Oh, it's like Nirvana." And I was like, "No, that's actually not Nirvana. Nirvana is not that place of having only pleasant and no unpleasant. That actually." is dukkha, just as it's unsatisfactory, just as the painful experiences. It will be over time, it'll fade. Yeah, so that's that. So over time, with practice, we can learn to be more fully present with discomfort on the physical level. We don't automatically lump it in the bucket we call pain, and instead we look at it more closely. In one of the things that I also want to mention is that pain can be very fatiguing. So to bring your attention to pain for an extended period can be really debilitating. And you know, there are people who have chronic pain, who have pain conditions, and that can be very overwhelming. So I'm not... one teacher that I've heard, I think actually Ute Janiya, one of the Burmese teachers, he doesn't even teach people to be with pain initially. He says, no, it gets too messy. Go move away from pain. Move off to a different object. Other people suggest being with pain. In my experience, you want to be with pain, you want to touch into it, spend a little bit of time with it, investigate it, and then move away. Especially if you have a chronic pain condition or some kind of thing where it feels like you're getting trapped as soon as you move into the pain, you want to be very cautious about that, about how you move in there. You want to move in, spend a little bit of time with that, and then perhaps even open your eyes and look for the pleasant in terms of if that's something that really you get trapped in and really start to find yourself bracing with. So there are different ways of working with pain. In general, for many people, we want to simply move into that discomfort and simply practice with what is that like? What is it like? Oh, we're calling it pain. What is it actually like? Oh, there's some stretching there. Oh, it's unpleasant. It kind of changes a little bit. Sometimes it's unpleasant, sometimes it's not. Okay. All right. And so in this way, we just are with it in small, kind of bite-sized chunks. And when we're meditating for longer periods of time, many people in this room have been on meditation retreats, where you're on these residential retreats, and you're meditating, you know, pretty much all day. Sitting meditation, then walking meditation, then eating meditation, then bathing meditation, so on and so forth, all day long. And over time, in that place, pain can really break down and really shift into a very different experience where there's really not pain per se, there's simply this energy that's moving around. And so our capacity to be with that experience has really grown substantially. So this is something, if you haven't been on a retreat, that might be something to consider doing. If that's within your means, or if you have any interest about that, that's something that could be worth considering. From that place, in that place, what we find is that energy that we put into rejecting experience is now available to us. And the pain can be less fatiguing. There's no guarantee, but it can be less fatiguing, and it can be easier to work with. So when we get this in, and really kind of, I suppose initially I've been talking about this more kind of on the cushion, discomfort that arises on the cushion when the body stays in the same position for an extended period of time. And with the body, by the way, with the body in the same position for an extended period of time, discomfort will arise. And this is not a flaw in you. You are not special in that way. That will happen. So, but as we broaden and deepen our capacity to be with this discomfort on the cushion, in formal practice, then we can take that out of here into the world, right? To be with discomfort in other ways. So, and now I also want to talk about discomfort on the emotional level. And it really, it functions very similarly. How many people were here when Jacques Verdun was here from Insight Out? So a good chunk of you. So, wonderful guy. He runs this program called Insight Out at San Quentin. And now he's actually expanding it to some other prisons. And he leads this program called the GRIP program, Guiding Rage into Power. And I think it's like a year-long program. And they start off with giving the tribe a name. And there's maybe 30 to 40 men in the group, something like that. And they go around and they have each man say how many years of their life they spent incarcerated. And then they just tally that up. So for this group of 30 to 40 men, that total came out to 936. You know? So that was their name, Tribe 936. You know? And a lot of them had started in their teenage years. And then they add up the amount of time between when the triggering event happened and when they did the action that got them in prison. You know, they go around, well, how long was it for you, and so on and so forth. And they added up all of that. For this same group of men, the total was 44 minutes and 12 seconds. Yeah. So there are many factors that go into how these men ended up imprisoned. And the sentences that they receive, and you could certainly argue for the, you may have issues with sentencing practices, or feel one way or the other about that. But what I want to point out is just how powerful the consequences are, or can be, of not being able to be with the discomfort of our emotions. Many of us may have grown up in very different circumstances to a lot of these men, you know, that may have steered us onto a different track. So that's it can be a huge advantage for us. And we know that feeling of being overpowered by emotion. Does anybody not know that? Yeah. So with emotions, just like with the physical sensations, we experience them in the body, in the mind and heart, yeah, and in the body. So there's the emotion, could be pleasant, could be unpleasant, and then generally based on that pleasant or unpleasant, we want to get more of it, get it, make it bigger, have it stay, or have it get smaller and go away, be replaced with something else. And, you know, so it's really, it's like if we look at this really closely, it's something that we can't be with, you know. It can be a very gross level of, get it the hell away from me. Or it can be very subtle, this very subtle resistance, this not wanting it to be that way. Just kind of nudging it away, something like that. You know, if you practice for an extended period of time, actually if you're human, do we have any human beings here this evening? Okay, we have one here. Okay. You know, if you practice for any extended period of time, if you live for any extended period of time, all kinds of these visitors are going to come, these emotions are going to come. Sadness, joy, anger, peace, envy, calm, happiness, confusion, so on and so on. Right? We're going to know all of these. And There's, you know, we can, just as with the physical experience, with physical discomfort, we can deepen our ability over time to be with the emotional discomfort so that we don't lose our balance so much with it. When I first started meditating, I had a lot of anger. I would sit down and within 5 minutes, I would just be fuming. I just had this anger coming through here. And this went on, you know, not necessarily every sit, but this went on a lot for the first 2 or 3 years of my practice. And it kind of, over time, it kind of burned itself out or burned itself down. It's not that I don't get angry or have that arise in meditation at all anymore, but it's... it may, kind of to quote Philip, it may characterize my experience in a given moment or for a given period of meditation, but it doesn't define the experience. And, you know, Philip often talks about the reactive, Philip Moffat, who's my main teacher, and he was actually the founding teacher here at Ren Sangha, as most of you know, and some of you may not. So he talks about the reactive mind versus the responsive mind. So in general, the untrained mind is kind of the reactive mind. We don't have this ability to be with the physical discomfort, the emotional discomfort, which includes boredom, yeah? I want something. I need some stimulation here. Any of that initial level of the experience comes and we react to it. We get into an argument with our husband, wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, partner, partners, whoever, right? Co-workers, or we shut down, whatever. All the many ways that we do this. Okay. Through bringing mindfulness to our experience, be able to be with our experience, over time we deepen that ability to be with it so that we can be with it more fully. And in that place, we have the possibility to respond rather than just go with our knee-jerk reaction. So the reactive mind has no freedom in it. Over time and with practice, we can build, we can strengthen our mindfulness and broaden and deepen our ability to be with experience so that we can be more responsive. And from that place, there's so much more freedom there, so much more ability to be with. And then when somebody says something that might have gotten us reactive, we all of a sudden we surprise ourselves. We don't get reactive back. Oh, we actually have at least a moment of just kind of, oh, ourselves. Oh, it stung a little bit, but nothing like it used to. Yeah. So, many of you have heard the RAIN acronym before. And I was looking this up online. I couldn't remember what exactly they were. I know there are different versions of it. But one of the things that I did know is I've heard it so many times over the years, but I didn't realize that it was attributed to Michelle McDonald, one of the teachers in kind of the Spirit Rock IMS tradition. So, RAIN, the R is for recognize. Recognize what's going on. The A is for allow. Allow the experience to be there just as it is. I, investigate with kindness. So it's not this harsh investigation. It's this spacious, kind investigation. Not a judging, blaming investigation. And then the N for non-identifying with the experience. Seeing the impersonal nature of it. Knowing that everybody in this room has had anger. Everybody in this room has had physical pain. That we can do that. Over time, we can work with this RAIN acronym with ourselves. Recognize what's going on. Allow the experience to be there just as it is. Investigate with kindness. and then non-identifying, not getting caught in making it about me and mine. And yeah, this is useful. You don't have to be a lifer in the GRIP program at San Quentin to make use of this. Actually, just a lifer in this lifetime is enough. So with the emotions, just as with physical experiences, what we practice on the cushion can lead to greater ease and greater capacity in the world, in our relationships, at work, at home, with family, with friends, in all these situations. So, quick check-in. How's the discomfort? Anybody having discomfort that they want to mention? Yeah?
No, just physical discomfort.
Oh, yeah. Now, is it any aversion to it, or?
Yes.
Yeah.
I want to move.
You want it to move.
No, I don't. I want to move now.
You want to move now. You get to move now.
Oh, I know. I'm here.
There we go. Great. Okay. Yeah. So one of the things I just want to mention, just noticing if there's any bargain making. Yeah, I'll be mindful, but I'm being mindful, so it should go away. Yeah. Anybody else had that? I don't think I'm the only one. Eh? Right. Okay. Yeah. Anybody else want to talk about their discomfort? Mary.
I got to sit with it on a retreat,
uh-huh.
And the first 2 days of the adolescent retreat, and the first 2 days were the conversation that I was having with myself about what was going on. It got to the point where it was ludicrous.
Yeah.
It was ludicrous.
Yeah.
But what I found was, and this is one of what you just said, when I let go of the aversion, and it's just like, it is what it is, but the phrase that came to me was like, oh well, and it was kind of like a really spacious oh well.
Yeah.
It didn't make it pleasant, but I wasn't as exhausted.
Right, right. Yeah, the pain can be... when we have that aversive relationship to it, which is very normal, you know, as I mentioned, we're already wired that way.
And I don't think of it as pain, right? It's just discomfort. It's not comfortable.
Right.
But it's not really. To me, pain is something else.
Yeah.
You know, this yeah. So just yeah, it's just I'm not comfortable. It's discomfort.
Great. So now I want to talk a little bit of the collective level. And what is the collective level? That's the level of the group, the level of society, these different groups that form our society. So as we start to talk about the, you know, as individuals, we have our own discomfort on the physical and emotional level. What happens on this collective level? Who carries the burden of discomfort there? You know, in this country, in my estimation, this is my estimation, you don't have to buy this, but in my estimation, that discomfort ends up being carried kind of disproportionately by specific groups. Mm-hmm. You know, there may be more dominant groups, and then groups that are more dominated or pushed out in certain ways. So in this country, I would say groups that are end up carrying that burden more, I would say people of color, women, the LGBTQI community, people whose gender doesn't match societal norms, people whose bodies are different, you know, the list goes on. For many people in these groups, there can be a strong experience of being made to feel other, being made to feel abnormal, just over and over, repeatedly, many times. would say, so I guess what I'm arguing is that this is, this can be a very valuable, useful, worthwhile field for us in our practice to explore some. There's that quote from Ajahn Chah, there are two kinds of suffering, the suffering that leads to more suffering and the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. If you're not willing to be with the second kind of suffering, you'll surely continue to experience more of the first. Yeah. So how can we learn to go across these areas of our own privilege? Yeah. So if we're white, going into that area so that we can explore that some and learn in that area so that we're not perpetuating these ways that make for this kind of continual chafing for people of color around that white people of color grouping there. Or for men, what can we do to learn more about that so that we're not creating discomfort for women there? I read that, if you ask a group of men what they do for safety, you know, it's a pretty brief conversation, you know, we have a different relationship to it, though it may depend on the circumstances that we're living in, yeah. But if you asked a group of women, a similar group of women to the men, the experience would be very different around that. Yeah? The things that you do to keep yourself safe. That's a very different experience for women than it is for men. And I'm seeing a number of women who are nodding here. Okay. So now I'm going to read a quote that I think is very powerful. And could also increase the discomfort. And it's from a woman named Robin DiAngelo, a white woman who does a lot of work around working with privilege and things like that, in particular around color, race and color. She says, "I am a white woman. I am standing beside a black woman. We are facing a group of white people who are seated in front of us. We are in their workplace and have been hired by their employer to lead them in a dialogue about race. The room is filled with tension and charged with hostility. I have just presented a definition of racism that includes the acknowledgement that whites hold social and institutional power over people of color. A white man is pounding his fist on the table. His face is red and he is furious. As he pounds, he yells, 'White people have been discriminated against for 25 years. A white person can't get a job anymore.' I look around the room and see 40 employed people, all white. There are no people of color in this workplace. Something is happening here. And it isn't based on the racial reality of the workplace. I am feeling unnerved by this man's disconnection with that reality and his lack of sensitivity to the impact this is having on my co-facilitator, the only person of color in the room. Why is this white man so angry? Why is he being so careless about the impact of his anger? Why are all the other white people either sitting in silent agreement with him or tuning out? We have, after all, only articulated a definition of racism." So just take a moment. The room is in a very different place now than it was a few minutes ago. Just take a moment and sense in and notice what your own experience is. What are the sensations in the body? What emotions are present? Is the heart beating more quickly? Did certain thoughts arise? Can we just be with the emotions, the thoughts that arise there. And just noticing where you go. Noticing if aversion arises. Noticing if pleasant or unpleasant. And, yeah. So just noticing, even on the level of thinking, you know, sometimes people in a dominant group, if they hear something that may reflect in a way that they feel is not positive about that group, we identify with a different group that we're a part of that is not the dominant group. So just noticing if that's happening. Rushing to identify in this way. We'll get away from whatever the guilt or the discomfort in that way. Just noticing what your experience is. Not a right or wrong. Just being mindful of that. And seeing if you can increase the compassion, increase the curiosity. You know, even though we're talking about the collective level, we still are individual beings, right? We still have this experience that's arising on the physical level, the emotional level, all the time there. So in terms of investigating this collective level, for me, as someone who identifies as a straight, white, able-bodied man, middle class, or maybe even upper middle class man, with a committed Dharma practice, I'm seeing how this, more and more I'm seeing how this can really be, as opposed to just being a political issue, we could certainly engage in it on that level, but I'm really seeing how this can really be an issue of Dharma practice. Very fertile ground for Dharma practice. You know, as the Ajahn quote really sums it up, you know, if we can't be the dukkha that is caused by our thoughts and words and actions and on a collective level, you know, then how much can we really move towards freedom? You know?
Could you repeat that?
Can I repeat that? If we, the quote... the quote is, there are two kinds of suffering. Where is it? There are two kinds of suffering. The suffering that leads to more suffering and the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. If you're not willing to be with the second kind of suffering, you'll surely continue to experience more of the first. So, and I just want to acknowledge that, as I said early on in the talk, the desire for comfort is very strong. And there's nothing wrong with that. There is nothing wrong with that desire for comfort and to move away from discomfort. However, if we don't broaden our capacity, then we're kind of the puppet on the string. I want to read another kind of excerpt from this article on white supremacy culture by Tema Okun of dismantlingracism.org. And he talks about these many different ways in which white supremacy culture shows itself or can show itself in organizations and groups and things like that. One of them that he talks about is the right to comfort. Feeling like there's a right to comfort. The belief that that we have a right to emotional and psychological comfort. Yeah. Scapegoating those who cause discomfort. Equating individual acts of unfairness against white people with systemic racism, which daily targets people of color. Yeah. So he talks about some of that stuff. And then also some of the antidotes here. So the antidotes to working with this right of comfort, the right to comfort, understanding that discomfort is the root of all growth and learning. So just as it is with this physical, with this ankle pain, this knee pain, this itch, just as it is with that, it also is with learning to be with our emotions and in all of these different areas of life. So that's the antidote number one. Second is welcome it as much as you can. So recognize it and allow it. Yeah. Here he talks a little bit about deepening your political analysis of racism and oppression, which you may choose to do or not. And the fourth is don't take everything personally. So out of that list of four, and this is a, you know, this website is not a Dharma website. But out of that list of four antidotes to working with this right of comfort, I think three of those are really solid Dharma teachings there, Dharma instruction there. Understand that discomfort is the root of growth, welcome it, allow it, and don't take it personally. Okay. So, I want to end with a quote and have some time for some questions. And I don't know where I got this, but it's a it's got to be Thai, because it's about Longpo Dun lived at his monastery for 50 years. It's in the middle of town and is quite noisy. For any of the monks and novices who are not firm in their practice, it can be quite disrupting. Whenever anyone would complain, Longpo would instruct, "Why are you bothering to take interest in such things? It's ordinary for light to be bright. It's ordinary for sound to make noise. That's its duty. If we don't take an interest in it, it stops right there. Look after yourself so that you're not an enemy to the circumstances you are in, because the circumstances are just that way. That's all. Just see things with true wisdom, and that's enough." So, questions, comments, thoughts?
So, I've been working, I guess, for me it's like thinking of something, when I'm othering people. So, and it's really, it's been interesting because with the political scene that we have going on in the country now, anger is so interesting because it really feels very powerful and it has this really great energy, but I have found that usually this, I have another feeling underneath it. And so, you know, you watch people say things which I think are, oh my God, how could you think that, you poor soul? And instead of getting angry about it, of course I'll other them. Like, I'm not like that, you know? And then I was thinking about it. It's like, you hear somebody saying just the things like, you know, oh my gosh, and I'm othering them, and then I just think, no, this is another human being. And I, you know, the circumstances that I was brought up in and the life that I have, I had a lot of gratitude for it. For the gifts I've been given. And just, you know, I can watch myself doing both, othering them and at the same time trying to have compassion for them for how fixed their mind is, and I feel really kind of deluded and they're just really angry, and I kept thinking there's stuff underneath that and they're never going to touch it probably, or they aren't going to, but it's just really interesting to see how I sit there and I feel like I'm riding on the edge of the boat. And it's been interesting to kind of practice it. If you stimulate anything political, it's just watching how you do that, and it's just like, you know, no, it's the whole like, there, but for the grace of God, go on. I would hope not, but then I said, well, how do I know?
Yeah. Well, it all depends on our views, right?
Uh-huh.
We may have certain views, and you know, the Buddha talked about right view.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right view did not. I don't believe right view has made an endorsement in this current election. Yeah. But we can notice that. We can definitely work with as practice how we're making somebody other,
mm-hmm.
right? Because we do that quite a bit. And we can do that based on political view. We can do that based on skin color, age, you know, all these different factors and things like that. So very useful to see. And to just notice where the mind and heart go, you know, to creating that separation.
It's to me, it's interesting the fact that I can watch myself like holding to you. You know, it's like almost like holding like into the, like, I'm so glad I'm not like that kind of attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
at the same time, going, well, and having compassion. And just
right.
like, you know, and just kind of.
Right. And compassion for yourself, too.
Yeah, well, yeah. At all of it. But yeah, I just like, this is, and it's hard to watch.
Yeah.
It's hard to be with.
Yeah.
Myself, yeah.
Stepping away from them.
Mm-hmm.
I thank you. I just love what you said. And thank you. I think this is a really rich topic to keep exploring in different ways. And I just had two comments. Thanks for reminding me about rain, which I have in so many notes
mm-hmm.
and all over the, you know, index cards and little slips of paper I have in various nooks and crannies. And then I forget about it. And man, that's a liberator. So thank you for mentioning that. And also, I'm really glad that you said what you said about chronic pain conditions. Because
yeah.
I too thought in the early years of my practice that I needed to mindful away my pain until through various inputs and circumstances, I decided it's not helpful for me to be in pain.
Mm-hmm.
It's detrimental.
Mm-hmm.
So I have, I think, a pretty good practice of sitting with and noticing, and then I run for the drugs. You know, whether it's Tylenol or something
mm-hmm.
else, it's good to be free of pain too, because as you said, it can really mess the mind up.
It can
really
mess up the mind, and it can really have a profound effect on the nervous system too.
Exactly, and the energy
pain over an extended
that it
period.
Sucks.
Yeah,
it just
yeah.
sucks up an energy. So, thanks for mentioning that too.
Sure.
I'm not sure I'm going to be able to articulate this very well, but I've been thinking a lot about this collective discomfort. And the issue of other, well, human nature doesn't know the boundaries between different groups. So if you are an other, or you perceive yourself as an other, so maybe you're a disabled person, or a person of color, or maybe you're that white person you talked about in the workplace who perceived himself as an other. There's this seductiveness about being the other and identifying with it more and more to the point where you're over-identifying with it and you need to be not... As I said, I'm having a little trouble expressing it, but there is this pull to take on this identity of the other. You know, I'm not a gay person, I'm a queer person. Queer means strange. This is who I am. I'm different from other people. And I'm going to identify more with people of my group who really understand it. And there is some real reality. I don't mean to dismiss or trivialize that in any way. But it's a balance, because it's so easy to get pulled into that identity and get angry about the injustices around it, whether real or perceived. And then that anger just clouds your ability to think clearly. And so I try to remember that, you know, even in my Facebook fights that I have over politics or whatever it is. And remember that I am the other and I am the large group too, and just try to keep the clarity and remember the N in rain and not identify.
Yeah. I think for some people in who are in those kind of non-dominant groups, dominated groups, it's I think the experience, at least from what I've heard, is often of being, they're just kind of these constant reminders of, this is you, this is how you're supposed to be, this is how you're, you know, not conforming, you know, and that starts to really chafe. So I think the you know, loosening identification is a great thing, and that needs to come from a place of feeling supported and whole and that kind of thing. So, and I think both of those have to happen, and they're both, you know, it's like, as you're saying, it's not one or the other. They're both important there.
It's not easy. Because those issues are definitely real in life.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things I just want to mention also is that this is the kind of thing that we could explore as a committed group, you know, as like a closed group, as a group of 12 people or 20 people or something for an extended period of time. So, which, if that were happening, there would be a way to kind of build up more of a... could be a way to build up more of a sense of safety to really explore this and explore all the thoughts that we have that are that may not feel tidy, you know, or I don't want to say this, you know. So I just want to mention that as well, that this, with the 7 minutes that we have left here this evening, not necessarily the best place to get into the thickest, heaviest stuff. But
I think you might want to skip me.
Oh yeah, you're welcome to, if you like.
As soon as you talked about a white woman and a black woman being there, I just, you know, it was a little tighter. Uh-huh. And I would say, even before I identify as being a woman, I identify as white. Mm-hmm. That is my first, you know, looking at it, that's my first level of identification. Mm-hmm. And I've been listening to Ta-Nehisi Coates, mm-hmm. Between the World and Me. Mm-hmm. He read his book. I've been listening. Mm-hmm. I'm on my third iteration of listening, mm-hmm. to him. And it's so powerful, mm-hmm. to listen to. And I don't know what to do with that. Other than recognize that blacks have had and continue to have a less comfortable life in this country than I as a white person may have, strictly by those, as he says, who insist on being white. He doesn't even think there's white people, that we insist on being white.
Yeah. Well, I think it's, as I talked about with that quote with Ajahn Chah, I think it's it can be very useful to open to that level of dukkha, of suffering that is caused, you know, that we may be complicit in, that we may be involved in on some level, that we get some advantage from, some privilege, mm-hmm. from, without necessarily having signed up for it, having said, hey, I want this, give it to me.
Right.
But we're still getting it. Or we may still be getting it. So, yeah, useful exploration. I think to the extent that it that it serves the deepening of compassion. I think it's a very useful thing. So, okay, 1, 2, 3.
I had a very unusual experience from 2003 to 2013. I lived on the East Coast in a neighborhood where I was one, maybe three white people, in a neighborhood of all people of color. And my job at that time, I would drive 20 miles out, and I worked in a neighborhood that was much like Marin. And it was such a strange juxtaposition, right? I was like, there must be. And my conclusion was, you know, not terribly original, but everybody was suffering. There, you know, it just seemed to take different forms. The people in the beautiful neighborhood had their own oppressors, you know, and I just wanted to share that.
Mm-hmm. I would agree that certainly the Buddha talked about the first noble truth is the truth of dukkha, the truth of suffering, of unsatisfactoriness, or that kind of thing. In terms of oppression, it'll depend how you want to define that. I think one thing that I've heard is that kind of the isms flow in the direction in which kind of the power runs. So in that way, the white people, we certainly have dukkha, we certainly have suffering. There's certainly suffering around being white, and some of that delusion in different ways. But I would say that we're, as white people, we aren't oppressed through our whiteness. We accrue an advantage based on whiteness, just as males accrue advantage based on maleness.
This is just quick. I don't know if you're interested. You talked about ways of exploring this. I've been to two workshops in my church for the last 2 weeks on white privilege, which have been very interesting. And there are things that there are ways you can do this in a group of people with trust. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, it can be very fertile ground.
I just want to thank you for raising it in such a great way that's not dialectic and not intellectual, but really just sensing into the body, which I think is just a really helpful way to start even thinking about it. So I wanted to thank you for that. That it's part of this collective discomfort, a collective suffering, and thinking about it in that way is a very different way of bringing yourself to that. And I just appreciate that.